Mike Morrell here with the Buzz Seminar, talking with Jeff Goines. You're probably already familiar with Jeff, but if you're not, Jeff is a writer, podcaster, and teacher. He likes to teach about the craft of writing, having an extensive reach online, and living a life of creativity, vocational alignment, and making a real impact on the world. So thank you so much for joining us for the special Buzz Seminar chat today, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Mike. That was a glowing introduction. I think I should copy that. Thanks for saying all those things.
Feel free. I feel it's accurate. So, you know, one of the first things that an aspiring author or blogger is likely to notice when visiting your website at goineswriter.com is that you're prolific. I mean, you blog, you write books, and you've even launched a podcast in the past year. So what I'm imagining our participants are wondering is, how do you do it, Jeff? How do you blog, write books, and podcast consistently?
You know, Mike, I shared this with you recently when we were hanging out together, and I read this quote by, you know, Marcus Aurelius recently about basically this idea that every obstacle can become an opportunity. My friend Ryan Holiday wrote a book about this called The Obstacle is the Way. And I love that the basic idea that the things that we think of as weaknesses in our lives can somehow be made strengths. And I think that's true. It's true for me. So, you know, one of the things that is totally a weakness of mine is my inability or my struggle with being able to focus on one thing at a time, you know, sort of this like mild, you know, undiagnosed ADHD where constantly so many things going on. And then, you know, if anybody's familiar with, you know, ADHD, and I'm not that familiar with it, but I seem to, you know, resonate with some of the symptoms.
It's in the air.
Yeah, it's either like you can't focus on a single thing at all, or once you get fixated on something, you are like consumed with it. And so, you know, you asked about being prolific, and I sort of feel that way. Like when I'm writing, I can't stop writing. But then, you know, like when I stop writing, there's this, you know, law of, you know, inertia where I'm just like, it's so hard to get moving again. So I think one of the ways that I am able to create a lot of stuff is by using that weakness of just kind of being all over the place, which I find is pretty common for a lot of creative people, a lot of writers, aspiring authors. You just feel like you have so many ideas. And I found for the longest time, I really tried to harness that and rein that in and just focus. And I don't do that anymore. So when I sit down to write, I don't write one blog post. I write three or four half blog posts, you know, or I jump around, you know, from chapter to chapter to chapter in a book. And for me, I find that I'm able to, in the long run, create much more work that way, you know, as opposed to thinking through a 1,000-word essay or, you know, a section in a chapter, writing it beginning, middle, and end all at once. That's a pretty imposing sort of challenge for me. Whereas if I just try to like create a bunch of different, you know, pieces, like a bunch of 250 snippets of the things that I'm most excited about, I end up, you know, being able to fill in, you know, the other, you know, 75% later on, you know. And so when I write, that's what I do is I jump around a lot. And I do that every day, and I think the trick to doing that is to not always be creating new projects for yourself, but to also go back and sort of, you know, fill in the cracks of some of the, you know, other projects that you know, you've been working on. And I do that every day. So when I write, I'm not just creating new content. I'm coming up with new ideas. I'm sort of filling in some of the old ideas, and then I'm taking some of those pieces and I'm making them, you know, ready to publish. And I do that with podcasting, with books, with everything. I'm just trying to constantly be creating without trying to be too structured about the process, other than I just try to sit down every day and do it.
Wow. So that begs the question then, how do you finish certain things given the ADD-like tendencies that you have and that you are jumping around? I guess the two-part question, one, how much of the stuff that you start do you finish? And then amongst the things that you finish, like what's your process with of going back to a piece of writing even though it might not be the latest shiny object that you're wanting to start?
I'm really uncomfortable with not finishing everything that I start.
Okay.
So I'm not going to say that there aren't, pieces sitting on my hard drive that, that haven't been there for years that I haven't brought to completion. But, the idea is that they're going to find a place somewhere. Like, I don't like coming up with stuff and then killing it. Now, I'll edit things out and, use those pieces or snippets elsewhere often. But I'm a big fan of, as much as people talk about killing your darlings, I sort of kill them and then resurrect them later. I'm a big fan of using your byproduct. So I try to finish everything that I start. I'm not saying that I'm perfect at it, but it's really important to me. And the way that I finish stuff is not by any sort of sheer will or discipline, but I complete projects when I have to, which means that I give myself a lot of drop-dead deadlines. Not fake self-imposed, oh, this would be great if I did this at this point. Like, I do everything that I can to basically force myself into a mode where I have to do this. I have to write this book. I have to turn it in on March 1st. I have to publish this blog post, or something bad is going to happen. And sometimes that something bad is my publisher is going to call me and say, hey, like, we paid you money, so you have to give us this book. Or it's, basically somebody's going to email me, a blog reader's going to email me and go, hey, it's Wednesday and I don't see, a blog post in my email and it's 7 a.m. Like, where is that? You usually do that. It's not here anymore. And it's, it's the disappointment of a reader. Now, these aren't like scenarios in which like I'm being publicly embarrassed necessarily, or, shamed, or, nobody in my family's dying, as a result of these consequences.
That's the next phase, right?
Yes, like the ultra deadline phase. But it's scary enough for me that I don't want to let those people down. And I'm not perfect at deadlines, but I know that some authors will, like, months go by with their, with their deadlines passing. I've just never been comfortable with that, and part of it is I know that people are counting on me. I know that I committed to something, and as a person who wants to, honor his word, I want to do everything that I can, understanding that I'm not perfect. I want to do everything that I can to honor that, to be a person of integrity, and to follow through on the things that I did. Let my yes be yes, and my no be no.
Yeah, somebody wise said that once. That's something good to live by.
Right.
Got it. So you let yourself roam free on the front end of your creative process, though even in that, you make sure that you do so consistently, and then your sense of integrity, your sense of not wanting to let things rest incomplete, inspires you to finish what you've started.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that sounds sort of noble the way you said it. Like, I just put myself in a position where if I don't do this, like, I'm gonna look silly. I am gonna look like a flake to people that I care about, not looking like a flake to. Like, my publisher, I shared with you recently, Mike, I created a new online course, and the way that I did that was by committing to publicly launching this on a webinar, in front of 10,000 people. Where, I was committing to somebody who was basically committing this to their audience, that if I didn't do this, I wasn't just letting this one person down that I didn't want to let down. I was letting down these 10,000 people that it had been promised to. And so it'd be very different from setting the goal of, I want to do this someday. I want to do this in October or whatever. And if I don't do it, nobody knows but me. And so I think that that's really important when you're, setting goals, whether it's, wanting to lose weight or, wanting to publish a book. I don't do stuff until I absolutely have to. And so the trick, I think, to being productive is to force yourself into those situations where you at least feel like, man, if I don't do this, this is going to be bad.
Sound like you are more of a stick person than a carrot person when it comes to motivation.
That's right. I hit myself hard with a stick.
Okay. Well, so when you're hitting your audience hard with a stick, one of the things that you have frequently done is you challenge those of us who call ourselves writers to actually sit down and write, and you recommend 500 words each day. I'm curious, how has this practice impacted your craft?
I think I stumbled upon this. I mean, I really stumbled upon this with blogging. I think most people would tell you a good word count number to shoot for is about 500 words per blog post. I think there's plenty of room on the internet for long form. You see a lot of this now, 1,000 to 2,000 word articles on blogs becoming more and more normative as people are trying to sort of up the game and, you know, create more substantial content. But, you know, you and I know, Mike, you know, we've been around the blogosphere for a while. You know, back in the day, you could like throw 150, 200 words up on a, you know, a couple of paragraphs up on a blog, and like, that was great. That was awesome. You know,
right.
It was just about the fact that you were blogging was remarkable in and of itself. It didn't even have to be some complete thought. You know, it was just the...
it was also novel.
Yeah, it was so novel. Yeah, it's a great way to put it. But as, you know, the medium has become more sophisticated, it's basically turned into journalism, you know, and we expect journalism to be, you know, well-researched and, you know, easy to read and relevant to the reader. And, you know, so I, you know, I got in the habit of writing about, you know, 500 words a day for my blog, and I would do that every day. My first year, I wrote over 300 blog posts and something like 100 guest posts. So, you know, you don't have to be a math major to know that you know, I was writing more than an article per day. And they were averaging about, you know, 500 to 7 words. And some of them were, you know, as long as 1,000 or 1,200 words. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I got into the habit with blogging. And then when I started writing my first book, I thought that, like, somehow it was going to change. Like, blogging wasn't real writing, and, you know, when I wrote my book, it would be different. Like, I don't know what I thought. And so I started trying to write, you know, the book from chapter 1 through chapter 10, and that got really intimidating. And I would try to, you know, start writing the chapter, you know, at the beginning and go to the end. And it's just – it like, I felt like it had to be very, you know, chronological. It had to be in the right order. And that was stifling. And I went to my editor and I said, I'm really struggling with this. Like, how do I write this book? And he said, write the part that you're most excited about. Like, write the thing that brings you the most energy. Start there. Start in the middle of the book. Hmm. Now, this doesn't work if you're, you know, a fiction author.
right.
Unless you can kind of chunk out the story and think in terms of scenes. And, you know, I think it can work with, you know, creative nonfiction and some fiction. But, you know, the general idea is just sit down and write a little bit. And if you do that enough over time, you're going to have a book. And so that's what I did. I sat down and I'd go, okay, if I broke up my book into, you know, basically little kind of like blog-like pieces, although there is this sort of larger arc connecting everything, what if I just did that every day? What if I wrote about 500 words, you know, and just did this to kind of get the manuscript done, get all the words down on paper, then go back and, you know, edit it and kind of weave everything together. And so that's what I did, and that's what I've done ever since for 4 books now, is write about, you know, 500 words a day. And my books are not super long. You know, most of them have been 40 to 60,000 words, you know, which is 150 to, you know, 200-ish pages. And, you know, you can get a book that length done, at least the initial manuscript done, in like 3 months, you know,
wow.
500 words a day, 5 days a week. You know, that's gonna, you know, that's gonna get you on your way pretty quickly. And so that's always been my practice. I think it's easy enough to do that. I can write about 500 words in less than 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us who are committed to writing a book or, you know, improving our writing, taking this craft seriously, you could probably find 30 minutes in your day and, you know, end of the day or, you know, first thing in the morning, get up 30 minutes early. You know, that's not going to make you too sleep deprived. Or even over your lunch break, you can find 30 minutes to, you know, hopefully create your life's work. And so for me, that's how it got started, and that's my practice, you know, to this day. And it's kind of the same idea of, you know, working out and physical fitness. Don't try to do a ton of it, you know, once in a while. Try to do a little bit every day, and as you do that, your muscles get stronger, your endurance gets better, and you can start increasing the amount that you're doing every day. So there are days when I've got deadlines, and, you know, I'm really in the zone, and I've blocked off all day to write, where I might write 5,000 words. But that day is the exception, and what has got me to the finish line more often than not is the daily practice of writing about 500 words a day.
Wow, yeah, that sounds very sustainable. And it's a good segue to the next thing I wanted to ask you, and I feel like you've already partially answered it. You know, for years, Jeff, you had a day job like many people who are listening to us right now. So how did you find the time to keep your day job and start working in the direction of what you're doing now?
It was the it was getting up early for me. So I mentioned you can write, you can chase your dream in the morning, in the evening, during your lunch break, kind of whenever you've got margin in your day. But I could never find time when I waited till the end of the day. And if I did it in the middle of the day, I was sort of felt distracted, or I felt like, I didn't want to be cheating my day job, and I certainly didn't want anybody to see me doing that and think I was, flaking out on my responsibilities. I felt guilt. I would have felt guilty for that. But there was something really beautiful about getting up early, writing, 500 or 1,000 words in the morning, and then, eating breakfast, getting dressed, and going to work. Where everything that happened after that day, if I had done the thing that I felt like I was born to do, that I was made to do, everything after was sort of gravy, as opposed to slogging your way through a day job that you may or may not love, and going, man, I hope I have enough energy tonight to do the thing that really makes me come alive right before I pass out, and go through the process all over again. It gave my day this energy that I started to really look forward to. And so initially it was a discipline to get up early. And then eventually I was going to bed early, going to bed, before 10 o'clock at night, and looking forward to getting up at 5 a.m. to start writing, because that was my most exciting part of the day. And instead of it making the rest of the day feel like it was downhill, it just, it made it, it I don't know, it made everything that happened afterwards feel okay. Kind of like, going for a run in the morning and having that endorphin high for the rest of the day. Like, you can just kind of, you can weather any bad thing that happens and just kind of let it roll off your back. And so for me, it was the discipline of getting up every morning and working on, writing, but also working on my blog, and maybe, checking in on social media or emailing a few people where I wanted to guest post, or, when I started working with the publisher, doing that correspondence then. So it was all of that stuff, but it was doing it in the margins of life instead of waiting for the perfect time to have an abundance of free time to focus on it, which I had waited years for that and never found it. So I started doing it early in the morning, and then there would be these little times, throughout the day where I might, pull out my phone or a notebook or write down an idea so that the next time, the next morning I had some time to sit down and write or work on the stream, I already knew what I was going to work on. And, kind of planning in the back of my mind that next thing, that was really helpful too. So setting aside a little bit of time in the morning was about an hour for me. And then in the margins of the day, sort of, either physically writing it out or planning in my mind, here's how I'm going to spend that next time, was really important. And it was fun too. It created this anticipation of, okay, the next time I have a free hour, this is what I'm going to do. But I think a lot of people get stuck because they're waiting for that perfect moment, which may or may not come.
Yeah, it sounds like starting your day that way and filling in some of the margins with that meaning and that sense of calling is a beautiful way to live. And if you're listening to this right now and you were attracted to the Buzz seminar because we're not talking about necessarily becoming some kind of multimillionaire, but we're talking about blue-collar blogging and publishing for profit, keep in mind that this might be your path. You might not ever leave your day job, but if you can create a rhythm of life where you're doing what you love in addition to doing your day job, this might be the perfect path for you. And at the same time, I imagine that you're also wondering, well, what if I do end up coming to a time when I shed my day job? And so I'm wondering, Jeff, at what point did you finally take the plunge and decide, look, I'm not Jeff Goines with a day job and I write on the side, but I'm Jeff Goines writer. When did you finally take the plunge and decide to do that full time? How did you decide when that step was right for you?
Well, I want to begin by saying, Mike, that I never this was never part of the plan. The plan was to basically supplement my wife's income. I knew writers didn't make any money. I knew a bunch of writers, knew a bunch of authors, live in Nashville, a lot of authors here, a lot of artists. Most of them are bivocational. Most of them are not making, big bucks off of their books, but they, do it for love and supplemental income. And so my goal was to replace my pregnant wife's income so that she could stay home and raise our son, which she really wanted to do. And I would have this kind of side gig that would, hopefully, and the dream was to, replace her income, which was a big and lofty dream. And then I would just, have a day job, and that was fine. So that happened with a self-published ebook. Within about 6 months, I had replaced her income, which astounded me. And
Wow,
then
yeah.
it kind of kept growing after that, and I kept finding, you know, I found out ways to start making money with the blog, and you know, got into creating online courses, and you know, just got introduced to a whole new world of work, to the point that my wife started asking me, "When are you going to quit your job?" And that was a scary question for me, and so I didn't want to do that. I mean, it sounded kind of crazy to me for us to both quit our jobs in the same year, much less, you know, in the same couple of months. And so I basically sort of like dared God to, you know, bless me, you know, to kind of meet me in this place where, you know, like if this is going to happen, here's what's going to happen, is essentially what happened. And so I said, okay, we're going to have to double our income again before the end of the year for me to feel secure enough to, you know, be able to pursue this, you know, and know that this isn't a crazy idea. Because at any moment, I was sure that, you know, the money was going to dry up and people are going to stop buying my books and that whole deal. So all that to say, you know, within the final few months of that last year, it happened again. I mean, we basically tripled our income that year, which gave us a nice little ramp for me to be able to quit my job and not have to worry about going out and having to kill something the next month. And I think it really depends on your temperament. I'm probably a little bit more risk averse than some people. I know friends that like they sort of have to burn the boats before they can, you know, fully commit to something. They can't have a backup plan. That sounded stressful to me, especially as a new dad and as a husband. You know, I had people relying on me. I wanted, it didn't need to be 100% safe, but it needed to be, you know, fairly secure. And the more I talk to people who have done this sort of thing, the more common I'm realizing the conservative approach to pursuing your dream is. I'm not saying it's the only way, but I'm surprised at how often what people describe as a leap of faith actually ends up looking more like building a bridge. And we took that approach. I mean, the bridge got built somewhat quickly. You know, it basically took about 2 years and change. I built the blog, built the audience in the first year, and the next year's kind of built the business around that. You know, to the point that, you know, it would have easily taken 6 to 12 months of not making any money before we would have had to start, you know, getting worried about, I got to go get another job. So I heard somebody say that if you can basically find a way for your side gig to replace 50% of your income, then that's a pretty good indication that you've got enough momentum to maybe make the plunge into, you know, doing it full time, especially if you're doing it like I was, 1 to 2 hours a day. You know, what if you all of a sudden have 38 more hours per week, you know, to work on this, or even, you know, 20 more hours? You know, that's a lot more, you know, resources to, you know, grow at that final 50%. But the other thing I would say is, you know, wait a little while. You know, I know people who, you know, get a book contract and 3 months later they quit their jobs. You know, that's probably not enough time. I mean, I would wait a minimum of 6 months and make sure that you're seeing something that's fairly predictable. Like every month you're doing this 50% number. You know, so there's some consistency there, and that you've got, you know, enough money in the bank that, you know, you could go, you know, at least a month or two without worrying what's going to happen to us. You know, have a nice little, you know, emergency fund in case things go south. Because, you know, I've worked for myself now for a couple of years, and things do go south, and there are months where you go, gosh, you know, what are we going to do this month? And, you know, we've done a good enough job of, you know, not spending every penny that we make so that when we have those down months, we're fine. You know, we're prepared for that. So, you know, those two things I would say, try to at least replace 50%, and then wait long enough. I waited 2 years. I would recommend you wait at least 6 months.
That makes sense. Sustainable dreaming.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to sound like I'm super Mr. Conservative guy. Like the selfish motivation in this was, I didn't want to have to go back to my day job. I didn't want to have to go back and work for somebody ever again. And so, if I was going to launch, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to launch. I wanted to end up in outer space, not, you know, go 20 feet and then crash in the ocean or something.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, you know, you've been doing this for full time for a couple of years now. You've been taking a lot of would-be authors and bloggers under your wing, training them through your online courses and trainings. What's one of the biggest mistakes that you see would-be authors and bloggers making out there?
I think there's two mistakes. They're related, but it's they are kind of distinct too. One is authors don't think they need a brand. They go, I don't need a website or a Twitter handle or any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they often say, well, that's just too narcissistic. I just want to write my books. Mm-hmm. And I challenged somebody on this once. I said, okay, like, you don't like social media because it seems narcissistic. Right. I don't want to tweet about what I'm eating today for lunch. Nobody cares about that. Mm-hmm. And I go, yeah, I totally get that. That makes sense. I said, so social media is narcissistic. Got it. Just tell me, what do you think is more narcissistic? Trying to provide helpful, interesting content on Twitter and Facebook to engage with fans so that you can earn their trust, so that hopefully they're interested in the things that you're doing, like, you know, writing books, or to just write books and expect people to buy them just because they're great and, you know, you don't have to do anything to earn their trust or, you know, build a relationship with them.
Zing.
I was being a bit, you know, tongue in cheek there, but I think it's a real subtle form of arrogance and narcissism to say, I just want to write.
Yeah.
But the implication there is I want to write sustainably. I want to write in a way where I don't have to worry about keeping the heat on in the winter. You know, and we just had one of the coldest weeks of the year in Nashville, and it was 3 degrees out.
Yes, you did. I was just there.
I don't want to have to worry about keeping the heat on. Like, I want to know people are going to buy my books this week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the ways that you do that is think of yourself not just as an artist whose art gets discovered eventually someday, but as, you know, an entrepreneur, you know, as a business, you know, or at least somebody who is in the business of creating stuff that people want to buy. And I'm not saying that you have to pander to your audience, but you do have to acknowledge the fact that you have a brand. You aren't a brand. Like, I hate this idea that, like, you are just, you know, a Nike swoosh symbol. That's not true. I mean, you are a, you know, beautifully complex and, you know, interesting, you know, creature, but you have a brand. In other words, you are making an impression on somebody, and, you know, shouldn't you have some say in the impression that you're making? Mm-hmm. You know, the author who doesn't have a blog or isn't accessible to his fans, or, you know, the artist who, you know, just sits in a cabin and paints and writes songs, like, they're making an impression. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm not saying one is better than the other. But this idea that you, like, don't have a brand just because you choose not to, that's not true. I mean, right. That's like saying, I'm not leaving an impression when I go to a party and I just blow everybody off. Like, no, you're leaving an impression. Even though you didn't say anything to anybody, yep. Like, people are thinking things about you. And some of those things aren't so good. So yeah. I push people in the direction of taking ownership of their brand, whatever they want that to be. Your brand can be, I'm not on Twitter because I think social media is narcissistic, but I, you know, I write these beautiful essays on my website because, hello, it's, you know, 2015 and, you know, we have this thing called the internet and it's free to post content on it. And if you're a writer and a content creator and you're not putting stuff on this amazing web of information, you're missing out.
Yeah,
but whatever that brand is, you can have a say in creating it. And then the other thing that is related to that, a little bit more technical, is just the tendency for aspiring authors, would-be authors, as you said, to be really resistant to having an email list. Hmm. And I am such a fan of this. I mean, I think that my biggest fans, what I consider my inner circle of people that read my stuff and connect with me, that's my email list. Those are the best action takers, you know, the tribal leaders who go out and champion my work to other people. And it's the place that I am the most accessible personally to a lot of my readers is through my email list. And I just think, you know, authors who aren't, you know, getting on board with having an email list are leaving a lot on the table. I mean, email, I think, is still the best way to connect and communicate with people online, simply for the reason that it's universal. Like, everybody has an email address. If email was a social network, it would be the largest social network. It would be larger than Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google+, all of those combined times two or more. I mean,
yeah, we tend to overlook email because it's been around for so long.
Yeah, and I think the lasting power of it says something about, you know, probably how long it's going to stick around as well. You know, it's been, I think email started in like 1993. I mean, it is old. I mean, it in some ways predates the World Wide Web. It's a powerful communication medium. It's easy. Yeah, some people check Facebook more than they check their email. But I guarantee you, like everybody who has an email address is checking their email at some point. And if you want the most universal way to communicate with the most amount of people online, it's through email.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think for would-be writers, aspiring writers, and bloggers who are kind of introverted, it's sort of paradoxically easier for them to wrap their heads around having, say, a blog where there's this kind of communication in that way, whereas email's intimate, it's going directly into people's inboxes.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's powerful too. You are, to them, you're having a one-on-one conversation with your reader. It's not a one-to-many. It feels like one-to-many to you, but it's really one-to-one.
So you would recommend, sort of healthy replacement habits being if aspiring creators can let go of the hubris of thinking that they're kind of above having a brand, having an intentionally crafted brand and a social media presence, and to especially within that mix to embrace email.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, letting go of your hubris might sound a little, audacious. I don't even know that I've done that yet, but
I'm
I would
working on
challenge
it,
you to try it and see, try it on and see if it fits. And if it doesn't, send it back to the store. But I did this on a whim. I thought, everybody's talking about email. I'll start an email list. And I was surprised at how much I started to look forward to seeing how people were replying to my email newsletters, which was just my blog post going out in email form. So I'm not saying that you have to do a bunch more work. It's just a matter of providing a medium by which you're communicating directly with your readers. But as you mentioned, Mike, it's a personal, private way to connect with people. I'm amazed at the things that people share with me over email, usually in response to that newsletter, that they would never post as a comment on a blog. It's one of the best ways to build trust and also find how your work is impacting people.
Yeah, that's powerful. Well, so Buzz Seminar students are interested, not only in the craft of writing, which we've touched on, but then also actually earning a living through their words, ideas, and message, which we've also been chatting about here some. So in the course itself, Frank, Dave, Michelle, and I go into specific strategies to help writers write profitably. And, that said, I also love some of the unique things that you do to earn a sustainable living. Could you share one income-earning tip that you practice?
Sure. And this kind of depends on the kind of writing that you do. But one of the things that I kind of fell into, Mike, was basically creating information products, which I don't really love that term, but I mean, it is what it is. It sort of has this like internet marketing, smarminess connotation to it, at least to me. But it's basically if you're, I mean, this is an information product, right? Like helping people provide some sort of proprietary information that helps them get to where they're going or helps them, learn some sort of practical skill is, basically an info product. So I fell into this by creating, online courses, as I mentioned. But you can't just go out and create something. That is a recipe for disaster. And sadly, it's what most artists turn to. And I think creating, an info product like an online course or an ebook or, whatever is, if you want it to be successful, if you want to make money off of it, it's a little bit different from, just sitting down and, pouring out your heart on the page of, a computer screen that turn in that could turn into a book or something. And so my one tip is this: before you create anything, start building the audience, and then as soon as you, build even just a small audience, 10 or 12 people, ask them what they want. And don't just ask them what they want. Hey, what do you want? We gathered you here to find out what you want because that's, a little bit abstract. But before you ask them what they want, ask them what they're struggling with. And the best way to get people to open up with what they're struggling with is to talk about the things that you have or currently are struggling with. And once you start kind of opening the vein and inviting people to be vulnerable, it's amazing the things that you'll hear people share and the way that they describe their problems. And when you can figure out what problems people are having that you have the solution to, whether that solution is hope or entertainment or here's some practical information, You've got a business model. You've got something that people have told you that they want, and you've got the goods. You've got the, you know, you've got the knowledge or the resources or the expertise to go and create this thing. And I know that the Buzz Seminar is an example of this, Mike. You know, people have been asking you and Frank, especially, for years, some of these questions, and you decided to formalize it and put it together in a format that allowed you to share information, you know, make money, and help a lot of people, you know, in a short amount of time. And I think the best thing that you can do when you're trying to find out what should I create that, you know, that I want to make money, go find out what people want. And instead of going and building the thing and then trying to market it or promote it, go and find out what people want and then build the product that people are already asking for. Build the service that people already want. And when you build it, make sure that you're listening to the specific things that people are saying, because they're basically telling you what your marketing message is when they're describing their pain or their struggle. They're saying, this is what I need to hear in order for me to, you know, value this enough to want to buy it. And that has never done me wrong. Everything that I create, even the books that I write, I try to get a pulse on what my audience wants, what they're struggling with, and how I can come in and fill that need. I think it was Frederick Buechner who said, and this is a paraphrase, you know, your calling is that place where your deepest joy meets the world's deepest need. And so it's not just I'm creating stuff that people need, it's I'm finding out what people need so that I can bring something that I'm good at, something that I love doing that brings me joy, and I'm combining those in a way that you know, is a really powerful combination.
Wow, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so, like, if you happen to be an entrepreneur or in business, you listen to where your audience needs help in building their businesses. If you're a minister or a spiritual teacher, you're listening to where people are feeling pain and alienation and, you know, a greater desire for connection with the sacred and with each other. And I have a question. How would, like, say, a fiction writer or a novelist, someone like that, approach this if they were wanting to create, for lack of a better word, information products or some kind of more premium offering to their readership?
Well, I think there's two ways to do it, and you have to look at some... You know, you have to look at what you do as multifaceted. I mean, you don't just have one type of reader. You have lots of different types of readers. And you don't need, you know, 80% of your readers to buy something like this. You need 20% of them to buy, you know, to buy it to make it worth your while. You just need to charge accordingly to make it worth your while. You know, one of the ways that this can be done is by creating something based on what you've done. So, for example, my friend Sean Platt, and he's got a couple of guys that write with him, and they write these dystopian novels. I mean, they write all vampire fiction. They write all kinds of just kind of fun stuff. And they put together a product for other fiction writers. So, I mean, they're doing it, but they have readers, you know, a small percentage of the readers who are also writers that want to do what they're doing. And they created an event where they had answered all these questions, and then they basically turned it in, just like you guys did, turn it into this like membership site and online course that people are now signing up for. So that's one way to do it, is to sort of focus on the fringe fans. If you're a fiction writer, the people who want to do what you're doing, which won't be everybody, it probably won't be the majority. So go after those people and teach them how to do what you do. You could do that.
Yeah.
Or go directly after the hardcore fans who want more and more, you know, fiction, and then figure out specifically, like, what have we not created that you want? Or what is, I mean, a good question to ask would be, like, what kind of, you know, what do you hate to read? Like, what are you sick of? You know, and somebody might go, oh, I'm sick of dystopian fiction because it's all over the place. Dystopian, you know, teen fiction. Great. Well, I'm not going to write that. But there is a certain group within those fans that are super fans that will buy everything that you have. And so what can be really powerful for, you know, more creative, you know, artists who are just, you know, they're writing novels or creating stuff that, you know, maybe you can't turn into a $500 information product. Well, there are ways to bundle your work, you know, where people just keep buying all of your books or they'll buy the whole series. And you see authors doing this, indie authors especially doing this now, where they'll sell the whole season of their upcoming, you know, $299 ebook series, and it's all 12 of them, and they'll pre-sell, you know, 1,000 of them. which is basically like I'm getting a book advance to now go write these novels. So, you know, I mean, to be practical, I would say you could sell directly to the people who want to do what you're doing, which is going to be kind of, you know, people on the fringe, or, you know, people that are a small minority of readers, or go after the fans and, you know, bundle your work in creative ways where, you know, they're buying the whole package, and you're just making it really easy for them to get all of your work, you know, in one place.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So either giving those who are interested in becoming authors themselves a peek behind the curtain into the craft, or, yeah, providing extra value for those who are appreciating the work itself. Well, so if it isn't already obvious to those of you listening today, we have only reached the tip of the iceberg with what Jeff practices to write both prolifically and profitably. And we're out of time for our conversation now. So, Jeff, I'm wondering, listeners here are probably wanting to go deeper with you to learn more about your work and how they can continue benefiting from your expertise. So where can they go? What specific resources of yours might you recommend to them?
You know, Mike, I mentioned that I love the connection that I get with people who read my email list. That's the first point of contact where I get connected with people. I don't, you know, take for granted that it takes time to earn people's trust. And so I hate when I listen to somebody and then they go, oh, go buy my stuff. Like, I don't want you to buy my stuff. I want you to come to my website and read my stuff. And if you like it, you know, sign up for the email list. And if you like that, you know, there'll be opportunities to buy things. But I'm interested in the connection. So the best place, you know, to go is just to go to my blog, which you already were kind enough to mention, which is coinswriter.com, like coins with a G, or, as I was reminded in middle school, like groins without the R.
There you go.
and now you won't be able to forget it. Coinswriter.com, and there's a, you know, it's very obvious where you can go sign up for my email list. I've got some free stuff that you can sign up for there. Lots of really helpful resources for aspiring authors and writers and creatives of all types. So thanks. This was great.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's true. You know, Jeff's email updates are one of the few that go directly to my inbox that I don't use unroll.me to filter out a lot of other unwanted or semi-wanted subscriptions. There's a lot of really practical tips that he gives, just like what we've been chatting about today, week in and week out. So thank you so much for your time today, Jeff.
Thank you, Mike. It was great. Mm-hmm.